Welcome. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. In studio with us today, Oscar Gastelum. I was so concerned about messing up the last name. I got the first one on. Oscar Gastelum, Gastelum Group Branch Manager with Commerce Mortgage. 18 years in the business. Oscar, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Also, Joe Roach with Coast Appraisal. He is our local appraiser. Joe, also, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Today, as probably no surprise, we're going to talk about mortgages and appraisals, which really are fairly intertwined. Obviously, if you're doing a refinance, there's appraisal involved. And if you're buying a home and commonly getting a mortgage, often appraisal involved for that.
There's a huge rush on real estate right now, and these are two people that are going to be involved in the process. So we're really here to dissect exactly what that process is and some of the changes that are taking place so that you're smarter through the process.
So everybody is out there calculating rate, looking at rates. That's always a important part of any decision in terms of the financial aspect of this process. Oscar, what are we talking about rate today?
Well, you know, rate, it depends a lot on how the client qualifies and, of course, the type of product they're looking into. There's so many factors that come into play. So, I mean, you can get a rate that can range anywhere between the low fours to the high fours, depending on product.
So, fours.
Fours. I guess it's safe to say, right?
Going around that right? One, man. We got you. We got you.
Dancing there?
Yeah, a little dancing.
So,
I got
you. So, if everything's perfect, 800 FICO score, loan amount under 417, 80% loan to value, obviously that's going to get you the better rate.
Absolutely.
Got it. So, four-ish, depending on your scenario, in general, is what today's rate is. And is that up or down? What's happening with rates recently?
Well, actually, believe it or not, they've been pretty stable now for the last couple of weeks. So, safe to say.
We experienced a bump up over the last, three or four months. And then I think it trickled down just a little bit,
just a little bit. And we've kind of been sitting here in the fours for a while now. So,
have you seen any change with the governmental shutdown in terms of rate, or has that been unaffected?
In terms of rate, no. At this point, it's been unaffected. So
that's surprising. Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing with the governmental shutdown? I mean, we're hearing that they're back in business. Are you still backed up with this? Or are you able to get FHA on the line and get these loans through? What's happening in your—
I mean, as of today, I mean, we're still experiencing some delays, you know, when it comes to ordering the 4506T, which is a verification of tax returns.
That's something you get from the IRS, right? And that's why the delay is, because I guess the idea here is that a consumer could submit to you for the qualification purposes a set of tax returns that are not necessarily the same ones they send in to the IRS. Is that right?
Exactly. So that needs to be verified directly with the IRS.
So you get a copy back from the IRS and
make sure the numbers match.
Obviously, if the IRS was shut down or the government was shut down, that made it a lot harder to do.
Absolutely.
Is it possible to get an FHA loan in 30 days now?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's still possible. I think we're experiencing most of the delays, at least what I've seen personally, is with VA appraisals right now. They're definitely taking a little bit longer. So I'm making sure I'm telling agents and buyers to try to give yourself a little bit more wiggle room when it comes to that. But with FHA, 30 days is realistic.
So the VA appraisals are slowing things down a little bit. So if you're out there getting a VA loan, 30 days may be unrealistic.
It may be. Yeah, absolutely. It's so unpredictable right now. You know, I think the norm has been 10 business days, and I think we're seeing anywhere between 15 to 18 days right now in responding.
Do you find that the sellers are compassionate about that?
From my experience, yes.
Yeah, I would think so.
Which is a good thing.
It's not the buyer's fault that the government got shut down.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, and also, when you get that far into a transaction, let's say you're 10 days before you close, and everybody's starting to say, look, it doesn't look like we're going to close on schedule. I mean, the shortest distance to getting the result that everybody's looking for is to go ahead and allow that extra flexibility in the estimated close date in order to get the deal done.
Right.
Why would you cancel a deal 10 days before you close just to put the house back on the market unless you had a backup for more money?
Right. It's just making sure the communication is there between everyone and everyone understands what the delays are.
Yeah.
So you have here on your list here how to get a loan in today's challenging yet rewarding market. And that's a concern many people have out there, is that the lending restrictions got so tight, nobody could get a loan. And that was the truth, 2007, 2008?
Right.
It was nearly impossible. But things have changed a little bit, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in reality, what it comes down to is being able to qualify. you know, there's three components that come into play, and that's cash, credit, and income. And you've got to be able to document that. It's not, you know, it's like going back in the early 2000s where you had your no docs, your stated income loans, where clients were not providing any supporting documentation, which is part of what got us in the mess we're in, or I should say we were in. But yeah, when it comes today, it's just a matter of being able to qualify.
So say the three things again.
Cash, credit, and income.
So credit, I would assume you just run the credit, right? It's fairly uncomplicated. It's either good or bad, and either fix it or don't. I mean, that's a pretty easy open and shut case. Cash, I'm guessing bank statements? Is that what?
Typically, we require 2 months bank statements. You know, we go a little bit deeper than that. It's not just verifying, hey, do you have enough to put down and cover your closing costs? We look at overall history as far as any odd deposits. Where's the money coming from? Typically, we like to see those funds seasoned for at least 60 days, preferably 90.
You know, Oscar, when you say we, are you looking at the underwriting guidelines that you have to follow, or is it that you guys have actual underwriters in your branch?
We have underwriters in our branch, but just in the banking sector. I mean, that's what banks look for. It's common practice.
So cash, credit, income being the third one.
Right.
Right. Now, I would imagine that's the most complicated, figuring out what someone actually makes. I mean, if they're a W-2 employee, not a big deal, but that's becoming less and less, I would imagine. What obstacles are you finding with respect to income, and what should someone expect to provide in the income bracket in order to get themselves a loan?
In the income bracket, typically we're looking for 2 years tax returns, federal tax returns, 1 month's worth of pay stubs is what we're looking for. But it's not just calculating income and looking at it and say, okay, this is how much you're making, this is how much you made last month. Depending on the type of work that they do, whether it's, you know, in some cases there's some bonus income, whether it can be averaged out. It's a lot of self-employed borrowers. When looking at 2 years tax returns or 1099 employees, the income is averaged for the last 24 months. So there's just different formulas also that's being used on how to calculate an income. And, of course, we're looking for a two-year job history minimum.
Minimum two-year job history.
In the same line of work.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Oscar Gastelum. His website, GastelumGroup.com. That's the website, GastelumGroup.com. GastelumGroup.com. We're talking about the three most important things that a lender looks for when getting a loan: money in the bank, credit score, and income. And calculating income is somewhat of a complicated part of the process. I would think it's the most complicated part. Is it?
It can be. To me, actually, where a lot of people get stuck is really when it comes to credit, coming back to credit. Yeah, it's as simple as pulling credit, but, you know, we look at same thing, FICO score, how they're managing their debts, you know, how maxed out they are. There's a lot of components that come into play when we look at an actual FICO score. And, of course, our overall debt, revolving and installment.
Well, I have some FICO score questions, and basically my questions are there's tiers in terms of what rate you'll get based on your score. We're going to get to that a little bit later, so I'm going to save that. But there certainly are some reductions in rate one can get by improving their FICO score, and it is a tiered system.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. So debt-to-income ratios. Obviously, that's a big part of the income. What are you seeing out there? What's the norm?
The norm I like to see is a 35 over 45. People might say, well, what is that?
Everybody says what is
that. Right? What is that? Well, the front-end ratio is usually a factor of income versus proposed monthly debt. Proposed monthly payment. That includes principal, interest, taxes, and insurance.
Typically, so front-end means just the home payment.
Just the home payment, correct.
So front-end means whatever other debt you have at this point doesn't matter with respect
to
the front end.
Be 35% more than 35% of your overall income.
Correct.
Gross.
Gross.
Okay. Gross, and I just want to be clear that it's the payment, PITI, so that's principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and if there's any HOA or Miller Roos included
also
for that
specific
property, you got to add that in.
So let's say one more time just to make sure we're clear. Front end debt to income ratio, 35% or better.
Or better.
Is what you're looking for. And so that if that means that you make $10,000 a month gross, your total monthly payment for the home should be $3,500 or less.
Correct.
Is that right?
And keep in mind, that's just it's a target. You know, we have some clients that they're at 36 or 37. It just depends on their overall
picture,
right.
Right.
And, of course, the back-end ratio, it's the combination of income versus that proposed mortgage payment and the total of all their credit debt.
So my car payment, alimony,
right.
child support, college
right.
loans, whatever else it is.
All that good
all
stuff.
All added in there.
All that good stuff.
And
so that shouldn't be more than 10% over the house payment.
Absolutely.
Now, what if you have rental properties?
If you have rental properties, that's a great question, by the way. If you have rental properties, a lot of times to say if the mortgage payment for that rental property is, say, $2,000, right? And the property rents out for $2,000. People think, well, I'm breaking even. Well, in a sense, what we use is 75% of that rental income, which when it comes to calculating their debt to income, there's an additional debt that we're going to factor in due to that rental.
$500 in, this, right. in your situation.
Right.
Got it. That's pretty common. The 75% is all right. you get. I mean, that's taking into account what it rent or not paying,
expenses.
Vacancy, expenses, mm-hmm. yeah, all the three things that go wrong when you're a landlord.
Well, what if it is making you a positive cash flow? Are they actually going to credit that to you? Is that
yeah,
considered
Yeah, that's
income?
Where there can be a credit. So, again, let's just say the mortgage payment is
$2,000,
right? Let's keep it the same. Uh-huh. And they're renting out the property for $2,600.
Okay.
So now at this point, you know, they're going to have, I mean, well, off the top of my head, I don't know what 75% of 2,600 is, but well, whatever that is over and above the 2,000 would be considered income.
I'd like to drill down just a little bit more on this because let's just say that you're filing your tax returns and you're depreciating the building and it looks to me like you're not making any money on this property. However, you've got a rental property that maybe the mortgage payment is $1,200 and you're renting it out for $2,200. You know, you've got a certain yield spread there. After you factor in the 75%, you're still positive
right.
in this case based
right.
on the lease agreement, but not based on your tax returns. What do you do in that case? What would a lender do?
We're going to go off of the net that's showing on the tax returns. And typically that's when we get those schedules involved. It's when we're dealing with self-employed borrowers. Typically, if it's a W-2 borrower, we're keeping it pretty simple with their 1040s. But
so
again,
most people are going to net zero.
Right.
Right. So in most cases, your rental properties are actually not going to help you.
I wouldn't say in most cases, no. I would not say in most cases. I mean, at least from my experience and the clients that I'm dealing with, in most cases, there is a positive cash flow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that would, of course, be added to the
income
bracket.
Right, which would play a factor in that debt to income.
We're talking with Oscar Gastelum, his website, GastelumGroup.com. That's the website, GastelumGroup.com, GASTELUM Group.com. When we come back, we're going to hear from our resident appraiser, Joe Roach, to talk about, well, the appraisal process in general and a little bit how REOs, short sales, and foreclosures factor into that and some things you can do to maximize your appraisal value ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. We just heard from Oscar Gastelum. His website, GastelumGroup.com. One more time, GastelumGroup.com. Talking about the three major influencing factors when getting a loan. Mortgage loan, of course. That's money, credit, and income. Seems pretty obvious, but we
right.
got into each one of them a little bit more detailed. Now, up to bat, Joe Roach. He's our resident appraiser, and, well, he's got a lot to say about the appraisal world.
Well, Joe, you know, you've been appraising properties for quite a while, and we've known each other for quite a while as well. You know, it seems to me that every single time that I look at the tax records, I'm always looking for what's wrong with the tax records, right? Because they're just not that accurate. And when it comes to selling real estate, there's price per square foot in the calculations for a lot of the analytical buyers. So you got this gross living area that you guys are measuring. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're correct in the sense that square footage of a home will absolutely affect the value. And from an appraisal standpoint, it's important that we get that square footage correct. Now, the tax records are one of the sources that we consult and verify. Very often, lenders are requiring us to actually include the assessor's tax record in there and then to rectify any information that we derive or come up with against that. So let's just say, and this happens all the time, let's just say that we're measuring a property. We discovered that the measurement that we take on the property is different than what the tax record shows. Well, that presents a little bit of a challenge because as an appraiser, I'm liable for delivering the correct information. So we've got a couple of things that we can do. Typically, we'll talk with the homeowner, discuss any additions that may have been made, see if those are permitted. If they're unsure because they've recently purchased the house or purchased it as is and thought that everything was kosher, then with their permission, we typically will go to the assessor's office or the county. We'll ask questions about the permit process, see if we can solve that issue. The bottom line is that every lender has their own particular set of guidelines that they're looking at. And we try and deliver, understanding who the lender is, we try and deliver the information that that lender is looking for so that we can get it right for the homeowner the first time. But you're right. If there are problems with the assessor's record, the public record, it really is something that the homeowner should take into their own hands to correct. I will say that there are several circumstances where a homeowner may not be quite as inclined to do that, and that is where their home is much larger than the square footage that they're paying tax on.
They reassess the homeowner in that case, or do they just keep it based on the purchase price of the home?
Well, you're referring to the assessor?
Yeah.
Yeah, very often what they're going to do is to try and update their record so that they reflect what is actually there. Sometimes what happens, too, is that we discover that what the assessor has in the record has actually been entered incorrectly. The appraiser that was entering that to begin with had two files in front of him. A phone rang or something, and he obtained information from another file, put it in there. We see mistakes all the time. And so it's important, and that's one of the tenets that I always advise clients to do, is to know your own property. Be familiar with what the characteristics of your own property are.
Well, quite commonly, Ryan and I will interview to sell a house, and let's just take, for example, the square footage is 2,950 square feet, right? I mean, we're pretty darn close to a milestone 3,000 square foot breaking point for a lot of buyers, because a lot of buyers will come in and say, I'm looking for a house, I need a minimum of 3,000 square feet. And with the MLS and the computer involved these days, there's a very analytical approach to grouping properties together. It doesn't have a, well, if it's 20% outside their specific parameters, we're going to include that anyway. It doesn't work that way. If the house is 3,000 square feet, it's in the group. If it's not 3,000 square feet, it's not in the group. So commonly, we'll actually have you come out, remeasure the property, give us an appraisal, if you will, so that way we're that much more prepared to talk with those analytical buyers when it comes to those price per square footage analysis. And so this is one of the reasons people do appraisals. What are some of the other reasons that you're seeing some people do appraisals these days?
Well, you're absolutely right. GLA clarification is one of the prime reasons, because it does affect value so much in both the sales as well as the refinance scenario. But some other reasons would be almost all financially related. This is one of the largest financial transactions that people undergo, so it's important that they handle these as professionally as they can. Divorce is a big one. Dissolution, partner buyouts, IRS issues. There are other reasons from an inheritance standpoint why date of death, limited percentages, partial interests, lease, land, various reasons why people would want to have an appraisal. But virtually every reason is going to focus around them being prudent with their finances, number one. And number two, that there's likely to be some type of federal reason or involvement. I mean, that's one of the guidelines for an appraisal, is that if federal funds are involved, then an appraisal is necessary.
If you're just tuning in, we're on the line with Joe Roach, Coast Appraisal Services. You can reach Joe with any questions you might have about appraisal at 619-518-3205. That's the number. Again, 619-518-3205. Here is a question that I've been dying to ask. What can someone do to their house that would actually persuade an appraiser to assign it more value than you might otherwise?
Well, generally speaking, I think one of the very best things that someone can do to assure maximum appraisal value is to begin with the exterior. That's also an area that would attract people. If you're in the process of selling, it's an area that would attract people to actually enter the home. Very often, people, as they drive up, if they don't like the way the home looks, they may just drive on.
I've been there before.
Even though it may look beautiful inside. Yeah.
First impressions.
So I encourage people to work to build curb appeal. For me, that's one of the very first indications that the inside has probably been as well attended to as the outside. So, and curb appeal, what does that usually mean? It means trimming any overgrown shrubbery. It means painting the door that's peeling. It may mean perhaps replacing some windows that needed to be replaced, say, 10 years ago. You may not necessarily do this just in preparation for sale, but building curb appeal helps to maintain not only home value but neighborhood value. And also, I would also recommend that people make those improvements that are in line with the neighborhood that they live in. In other words, be consistent with the nature of the improvements that other people have actually already put into their home.
You had mentioned a little bit in the past here about permitted area and gross living area. How does non-permitted areas play into this? Is that something that can be included in the square footage? And how do you determine whether it's permitted or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's actually the answer to that is yes and no.
Sweet.
And
take that one to the bank.
Yeah, it unfortunately is. It really is a gray area, and there's really not much that the appraiser can do with that, except that he or she needs to be able to recognize the circumstances where it could possibly be included. But one of the recommendations I always make for homeowners is to not cut corners, to get professional assistance and to make certain that if you're going to make any substantial investment in your property, such as an added room, to make sure that you spend a couple hundred dollars on the permit, because that room may add $10,000, $20,000 worth of value. But generally speaking, philosophically speaking, one of the appraisal tenets that we all have to abide by is that if there is unpermitted area, we have to count that as zero value. And in fact, we sometimes have to account for a cost to actually either remove that area or an estimated cost or to address the issue of what would it cost to return it to its permitted function. And one of the most common things that we see, of course, is a converted garage. It comes up all the time.
And actually, Joseph, if you don't mind me adding to that, on the financing side of it, we run into that a lot, you know, where homes are appraised. And let's just say there is a garage that's converted into a room. And of course, as you mentioned, it cannot be given any value. On the financing side of it, we're okay with it. You know, in most cases, depending on the structure, the lender may require that the structure be torn down due to health and safety reasons. But if it's done in a workmanlike manner, not given any value, and it's common to the area, then we're okay financing on that property. The main thing is it up to health and safety codes?
Well, I would think a converted garage, I've seen a lot of them, fairly obvious. There's a step down. It's a different slab pour. There's usually not heat to it. You know, it's really obvious that it was not intended to be a room. But if one was to add a room in the back and, you know, have not a step down, re-pour slabs, similar flooring, similar windows, similar stucco, do it, quote unquote, right, because right would be with an appraisal, or right would be with a permit, I would imagine it would be really hard for the appraiser to determine if it really is permitted or not. I mean, you're not pulling permits out the city, right?
Well, again, yes and no. Since we're liable for the data that goes into that report, we are legally liable for the length of that loan. So we have a potential 30-year liability. And if something happens, the example I always use, I try and give it black and white to the homeowner because that way it's easiest to understand. And let's just say that this unpermitted area catches fire and burns down, right? Burns down the house. Well, very often what has happened and what could happen in this particular case is that the insurance company would come in and say, well, if we had any idea that there were unpermitted areas, we would never have insured this property. We would have absolutely been certain to obtain a permit in that particular circumstance. But for that reason, it's a great idea to get a permit anytime you're going to do any type of addition. But let's just take it one step further, because this is another circumstance where we may be able to provide some information for someone who has that particular circumstance that they're living in right now. They purchase a home where there's an unpermitted area associated with it. What do we do with that?
Well, you know, that brings up a point. It's weighing in as a real estate professional. We can actually sell properties that have unpermitted areas as long as it's properly disclosed. I mean, people buy and sell property all the time that have these additions that haven't been permitted. We closed them this year with said problems. But, you know, like you're saying, when it comes to the appraisal, there can be some issues. You know, and we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to talk to Oscar Guslam about exactly what's happening with your loans and the appraisals when we come back. Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's a Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. We just heard from Joe Roach with Coast Appraisal Services. Talked about, well, non-permitted areas and a little bit about how deep they go to research the appraisal on any property. The phone number to reach Joe, 619-518-3205. One more time, 619-518-3205. Back to Oscar. I've got here on top of my list credit scores and how they impact your mortgage rate. Now, as I understand, Oscar, there are tiered buckets of credit scores that one might fit in that may have impact, good or bad, mm-hmm. on their rate or perhaps the points or fees they end up paying when they get a loan. How does that work?
Well, it's very hard to gauge specifically the cost, you know, according to FICO. But I would say definitely the tiers where you're seeing the steps are, say, from 580, say, to 640. You're falling under one bracket. The next tier would be from 641 to about 680. Of course, 681 to about 700 and 720 plus. It comes back to the formula between FICO score and down payment. That's going to determine their rate. So it's tough to gauge in saying, hey, you know, if I've got an FHA client, and FHA typically is the same across the board, but if I've got an FHA client with a 720 FICO score purchasing a $300,000 home, they're going to get a more competitive rate than my client that maybe has a 600. You know, we're dealing with a different investor. It prices out a lot different. And if the rate's the same, there may be a cost associated to that rate.
I certainly can see that different loan programs and other factors will change the rate. But the point I'm hoping to convey here is that you start at 580, so is it safe to assume anything 579 is really not lendable?
In most cases.
In most cases, yeah. Okay, so 580 is kind of the bottom of what we need in order to be lendable in general. So if I'm going to change my credit score from 580 to 585, I'm not going to get a better rate.
No, it's not going
to
make a
580
difference.
580 to 630, not going to get a better rate. So I got to hit out of that 640 bucket and land 641 to 680 to really see a change in rate. And so in that case, you're talking, what is that, 60-some, 80 points.
Right.
Is that realistic? Can people do that?
Oh, absolutely.
Rescore?
Yeah, there's rapid rescores. And that's how we highly encourage a lot of people, too, when they first start thinking about purchasing a home. We all know it's a process. Get them in contact with us. We do an evaluation, take their application, give them an idea of what they qualify for. Because in some cases, they may think, hey, I've got excellent credit. And then next thing you know, something pops up. They're thinking that they're at a 720, and then before you know it, they're at a 650. But in cases where they are at 650 or within those buckets, we can evaluate their credit, suggest maybe, say, like a rapid rescore, or even just looking at it where it might take them a couple of months, maybe paying down some accounts. So after 90 days where we have to repool credit, we can see that credit score come up, and it's going to put them in a better position.
Sounds like a race to me.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we've got interest rates going up.
Right.
We've got people that are trying to get their score in a bucket that actually gets them a better rate.
Right.
So if they don't do it fast enough, they're actually going to get stuck with the current rate, which could have been the one that they qualified at the beginning.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Absolutely. You know, that's the unfortunate side. You get a lot of clients that procrastinate. You know, they feel that they're ready because, you know, I've got a good job. I've been paying my bills on time. But they really don't know. I've had clients that have excellent credit, but they're maxed out. That plays a huge factor in their score.
You know, I tell you, these rapid rescore companies, not that any of them are represented right here, are actually pretty darn good.
They're great.
I've seen miracles happen. People might have, you know, a 580, and they tweak a few things, they do a few things, they move a few things around, and boom, they're in a qualified rate that gets them gets them the mortgage after all.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of times they may be in a good position, but our goal is to get them in a great, right? If we can put them in a better position down the line,
makes
absolutely.
Sense, because
that's
we're talking about saving money.
Right.
Everybody wants to maximize that loan that they're going to theoretically have for 30 years. I think the percentage of people that actually have their loan for 30 years is substantially down from what it is many, many generations ago. But theoretically, you're getting a 30-year loan and stuck with that rate for the duration.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times I've had buyers that are excited about seeing pretty pictures of homes and love walking through homes. And eventually we find one and make an offer only for them to find out that their credit score is not optimum. And it is so hard to convince them to start at that part of the process, because that's something that can easily take 2 to 3 months on a minimum to fix.
Right.
Any advice? I mean, other than getting ahead of it?
I mean, it's pretty much that. They just have to get started. You know, they have to. It's a consultation. It takes 10 minutes to take a loan app, you know, a few seconds to pull a credit. And
it really is the first step.
It is.
I mean, you're pretty much the gatekeeper to the whole process.
Right.
People get qualified. There's two different types of qualifications, right? There's a paper approval,
right,
pre-qualification, and there's actually qualified.
Right.
So when you're talking with somebody, you can just talk to them on the phone. A lot of times they'll go, hey, I'm pre-approved.
Right.
Which doesn't mean anything's been verified. They just take people's word for it, you know? And you're running credit, you're actually getting pay stubs and things like that. In fact, people can sign up on your website and get the process started right now.
Absolutely. GuestElmGroup.com. Yeah, the days of, you know, the napkin prequal in the car, those are gone. You know, it's having that 20-minute consultation with the client, finding out what their needs are. At that point, having them take the application, in most cases for me, online, takes a few minutes. And we can do a quick prequal, give them an idea of where they're at currently, and depending on their time frames, to put them in that position if they're looking to buy 90 days from now or 60 or 6 months from now, and getting them aligned with the right product that's going to match the property and area they're looking into.
You know, a few months ago, we were getting multiple offers on our properties. Maybe not so much right now with interest rates coming up. There's been some talk about the market shifting more to a buyer's market right now. You're seeing less appraisals right now, Joe. But, you know, with that whole process, getting a serious qualification mm-hmm. is really the key, because there are still a lot of investors out there that have cash.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every homeowner is going to respect the cash over a pre-approval, because the pre-approval is, you know, subject to a lot of verification.
Yeah.
They want to make sure that that buyer actually can get that loan.
I want to go back and talk a little bit about your buckets of credit scores. It ended at 721.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a 721 or more, mm-hmm. doesn't do me any good. What's the max I can get, like 815, 830?
I've seen 850.
850.
Yeah.
So if I have 721 or 850, I get the same rate.
Right.
No sense in getting any better than 721.
Right. And again, that's
financial
just
from a purely rate perspective.
Right.
Got it. That's good to know. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, essentially there's 4 buckets of credit. One more time, say what the buckets of credit are.
You're looking at, obviously on our bucket, the lowest is a 580. You're going from 580 to typically about 640. Or actually, I should say 639 in reality. And then from 640 to about
680 is what you have.
79. Actually, I've got to bring that down. Apologize. And then you go 680 to 700. And, of course, 701 to 720 is the other bracket. And, of course, 721 plus your charity.
Oh, so they get tighter as they get higher. I see it starts at about 80-point difference and gets higher. Well, that's good to know. So if you're gonna really improve your rate by improving your credit score, you got to make sure you jump to the next bucket.
Right.
That's really good advice.
You know, and rate plays a huge factor, of course, but it also can create flexibility for the client on their buying power as well. So, you know, how much flexibility there is in that debt-to-income ratio. If I've got a client that has, you know, a 640 FICO score, they might be limited to that 45 back-end ratio. You know, there's going to be more leniency, more flexibility. If I've got a client that has a 720 FICO score putting 20% down, we might be able to you know, extend that over to 47 or 48.
Make an exception.
Absolutely.
Compensating factors being the credit
score.
Exactly.
That's compensating factors. Correct.
Okay. Next thing I want to talk about, down payment amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many years ago, 100% was everywhere.
Right.
It's not the case anymore. Tell us what kind of down payment amounts out there and what makes sense. I know VA is going to be what – is that about the only 100% down thing there is?
Correct. Yeah.
100% loan. Excuse me. Nothing
100%
down.
Loan. Yeah. I mean, you've got some creative financing out there, you know, with the state. There's a product out there called CalAccess. You know, for instance, FHA requires 3.5% to put down, where they can get a silent second for 3%. In a sense, what's coming out of the client's pocket is 5% – or excuse me, 0.5%
mm-hmm.
down. And there's a silent second that carries a rate.
So what does that mean to be silent?
Meaning they're not required to make payments on that second. It is simple interest, so it has interest in most cases, say 5.25%, okay, for that 3%. But it's due payable. They can make payments on it if they wanted to. In most cases, they don't. They pay it off at the time they refinance and or sell the property.
So this loan is essentially a 3% loan that you don't have to pay back until the property is sold or refinanced.
Correct.
So that's the silent part of it.
Right.
Okay, so that's – we talked about nothing down,
mm-hmm.
then 0.5% down.
Right.
I would imagine there's substantial restrictions with FHA access. Are there income restrictions with that?
There are income restrictions. In some cases, there's restrictions to zip codes and, of course, purchase price.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that one is fairly complicated. To find out more about that, you can go to his website, gastelumgroup.com. That's the website, gastelumgroup.com. So FHA access, and then FHA would be the next step of least amount of down payment. What's that?
Which is 3.5% down.
3.5%. Yes. And what's FHA stand for? That's the government loan, right?
Federal Housing Administration. So it's a loan that's insured through FHA, and essentially what it's doing, it's insuring the lender in a case of default. If the client were to default on the loan, FHA insures the lender.
Insures the lender. And then what's the next step down in terms of most minimum down payment allowed beyond the 3.5%?
In other cases, you start looking into conventional financing, which can range anywhere between 5, 10, 15% down. In that window, they're going to require private mortgage insurance. The client will need to pay insurance on that. You know, there's different factors depending on the amount of money that they're putting down. Of course, the more they put down, the less the factor of the insurance. And anything over 20% down, you can get around the MI. Though
mortgage insurance,
correct. Though, you know, and if I've got a client that's putting, say, 10% down, you know, we've got seconds that are available. If they qualify with a 700 FICO score, we can provide them a second, get around the mortgage insurance. And when you factor in the payment with first, second, taxes, insurance versus your traditional, you know, 10% down product, there's going to be some savings monthly.
Normally, the MI is not a tax deduction, where the interest paid on the second would be. I've always found that to be the big difference.
Right. So, there's a benefit behind that.
Got it. Okay. So, that starts with zero, half, 3.5, and then five. You mentioned five was – there are 5% down conventional loans?
Mm-hmm.
Conventional.
Absolutely. Conventional.
Wow. I didn't know that existed.
Yeah.
One more time, to find out more information, gastelumgroup.com. That's the website, gastelumgroup.com, gastelumgroup.com.
So, you know, we've got FHA, and FHA requires mortgage insurance for the life of the loan at this point, right?
Correct.
And so if you do that 95% conventional program, are you able to have the lender revisit taking off mortgage insurance after the house is appreciated below the 80%?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you see the property and it puts you below the 80% loan to value, the client or the homeowner, I should say, can contact the lender and request the mortgage insurance to be removed. If it falls under 78%, the lender is required to automatically remove it. Going back to FHA, even though FHA does say that for the life of the loan, you have to have that mortgage insurance, people need to be made aware of that doesn't mean that you will always pay mortgage insurance.
You heard it here, ESPN Radio, Oscar Gastelum, Gastelum Group branch manager here with Commerce Mortgage, 18 years in the business. When we come back, we're going to talk with Joe Roach with Coast Appraisals about what you can do if the appraisal comes in too low.
Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's a Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. Just before the last break, we were talking with Oscar Gastelum. And we talked just a little about the new policy with FHA and how the mortgage insurance, MI, remains with the property, with the loan, for the duration that the loan is there. But there are some ways out of that.
Right, absolutely. I wanted to make sure and made that very clear. You know, like I said, you know, with FHA, it's required to stay on for the life of the loan. But the consumer, or the homeowner, I should say, needs to know that they have the option that once they're in the property and the property appreciates and they have 80% equity or more, they have the option of refinancing into a conventional loan and completely eliminating the mortgage insurance.
God, I would imagine they could also refi to an 80-10-10 too. I mean, you know, with the 10 being a second. I think
correct.
The idea here is it is life of that loan,
that
not the property.
One.
However you get rid of that loan really doesn't matter.
Right.
You get rid of the loan, the mortgage insurance goes with it, or potentially goes with it.
Right.
Got it. So that really brings us back to appraisal. It's got to appraise 16.5% or so in order to get rid of this mortgage insurance. That's where Joe comes in.
So, you know, reasons for an appraisal, naturally, you know, one of them is obviously a refinance. One could be a purchase. So, you know, when we're talking about refinancing and we're talking about trying to get rid of some of this mortgage insurance, you know, some of the things that come up are value, obviously. And The conundrum that I see right now is that a lot of people are sitting there with a lower interest rate because they got it a year ago, 6 months ago, and they've got a 3.5, maybe 3.75. Maybe it's got mortgage insurance. And it really comes down to, is it going to save you money? Is it going to make sense? Because if it doesn't make sense, why would you refinance? Why would you go through the trouble? If it makes sense, even at today's rate, for example, mortgage insurance is not cheap. And most people that I talk to that have mortgage insurance can't stand paying it anymore. They don't want to pay it a single month more than they have to. But the question becomes, is today's current multiplier with the interest rate and the new value of the refinance going to make that payment lower? Does it make sense to actually refinance and drop that MI, getting potentially a little bit higher interest rate? That's a great question for Oscar. 18 years in the business. When it comes to working that appraisal and making it right, we talked a little bit about the gross living area. We talked a little bit about curb appeal, first impressions. What happens, Joe, when we get low appraised values? What can a homeowner do?
Well, I think we mentioned early on that one of the suggestions for a homeowner was to be familiar with their property and to know their property. I recommend that each homeowner just compile everything there is to know about their property. From the property records, the property detail, whatever other sources they might be able to use or find, put that on a sheet somewhere and just put it into a file so that when it comes time for an appraisal, they can pull that property detail out and just go over the report itself. It's with all of the effort, with all of the hours and the data gathering that goes into an appraisal report, despite the focus and emphasis on detail, mistakes can be made. And certainly, if an appraisal is low, one of the very first things that a homeowner should do is to go over that appraisal. Make sure that the numbers are correct, that the zoning is correct. Make sure that the square footage of the lot is correct. Make sure that the square footage of the home is correct. And these are some of the details that they should be familiar with.
I've seen clients prepare something of a cheat sheet for an appraiser. And by that, I mean a list of improvements that they've made,
yes,
the cost they've paid for those improvements. And although I've seen them provide comps too, I mean, you have access to all those comps. I think that's kind of a waste of time. But really, I've seen that before, you know, kitchen, new kitchen, $30,000, bathroom, $10,000, blah, blah, blah. Are you able to take that into account, and does it work?
Well, absolutely. The more information that we have, the more accurate the value that we come up with will be reflected. And certainly, the one thing that we need to be clear on, though, and sometimes homeowners believe that if they bought the home for $500,000 and then they put $27,500 in it, then for goodness sakes, it should be worth at least $527,500. But that's not actually the way that it works. And so one thing that we could perhaps talk a bit about is where can a homeowner get the greatest bang for their buck on the improvements? But getting back to the low appraisal, there are sometimes reasons for those low appraisals. One of them can be the current predilection for banks to choose appraisers who are from another market. They may not even be familiar with the local market. And that might be something that you would want to look at. But I think that one of the first things that after the homeowner has surveyed the appraisal itself, reviewed the data, determined that perhaps there are no mistakes there or perhaps there are, one of the first things to do would be to have a conversation with the appraiser.
You know, and that's something that you prefer to take place. I mean, you're doing your job. You maybe have four or five appraisals every day. You know, you're doing your reconnaissance, your research, you're showing up at the property. You mentioned earlier that you do prefer potentially having a conversation with the homeowner. You know, obviously you don't want to spend the whole time with them. You got to measure the house. You got to do a lot. You got to do your walkthrough. However, there is an opportunity for a homeowner with respect to approach the appraiser at the time that, you know, the house is being appraised and say, you know, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job, but I've done some research that may save you some time. If you wouldn't mind taking a look at what I've got here, it may help the whole process. Because if you get it right the first time, it saves a lot of trouble and questioning. And you guys don't want to go through that. You want to get it right first time anyway.
That's right. And, you know, different appraisals have different methodologies. I actually remember I had an appraiser at one of my homes some time ago, and he was in and out so fast I never even got a chance to get up and shake his hand. Never said a word to me. Now, whether that's the right way or the wrong way is, you know, each person does it the way that they feel is serving their client the best. However, in our firm's situation, what we do is we sit down, have a brief conversation with the homeowner prior to leaving. What we do is we summarize what we found. We discuss the things that contribute the value. And we also go over the various things that every finish on every surface. We also talk about the ages of those finishes because those can impact value as well.
Yeah, actually, you've called me before asking me questions on, you know, David, how did you come up with this value? Because I'm having trouble here with my calculations, and really giving us the opportunity to justify, to prove why the house is worth this value so we don't have problems when it comes to the lender. You've actually had some problems before, Oscar, haven't you?
Yeah, actually, I have a case now that, you know, going into the transaction, the both the buying and selling side knew that the appraisal was going to come in lower than the purchase price, which it did. It came in at $30,000 less. So now they, you know, they're back to the negotiating table. They've got to figure it out. They're going to meet halfway. Is the client going to come in with some money out of pocket or simply just do a reduction to price?
I hate that, back to the negotiating table. Back to Joe. I got one final question for you, Joe. It's been my experience that the appraisal is really a one-time shot. Getting an appraisal changed after the fact has been nearly impossible. It's been my experience. Do you find that to be true as well? I mean, once it's done, once it's written on paper, unless there's some glaring mistake, the opinion of value that's been granted is really hard to change.
You know, I do a lot of appraisal review, and I find that to be the case as well. But what I will say is that the appraiser's job is to get that value correct from the outset. If a mistake has been made, or because remember that there are errors of omission, where they've omitted some information that could have led to perhaps a change in value. And there's errors of commission, meaning that they made a mistake in putting data into the particular file. So in both of those cases, if either one of those have occurred, or if it's even a gray area, I like to err on the side of conservatism and say, well, let's take a look at all the value, all the other information that's being presented. If it warrants a change in value, well, then, for goodness sake, let's get it done. It's not carved in stone anywhere, and it certainly is not. It doesn't mean that your opinion is wishy-washy.
We're talking with Joe Roach, Coast Appraisal Services. His number is 619-518-3205. One more time, 619-518-3205. Joe, thank you very much. Also, Oscar Gastelum, his website, GastelumGroup.com. That's GastelumGroup.com. GastelumGroup.com. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us. Coming up next, it's Tim Stromble with Sports Court.